our speaker for the day is going to talk to us about the Worcester tornado. It's all yours, John.
Good morning, everybody. How are you?
Good morning.
My name's John Horrigan. I'm ill. I've had severe sinusitis and bronchitis, so I'm going to try to hang in there. There's a lot of fight left in the old boy yet. It's a pleasure to be here at the Worcester Senior Center addressing the Worcester Low Vision Group. I have a special place in my heart for groups like you. I've been reading to visually impaired folks almost north of 18 years. So when I prepared this lecture as a slideshow, it came to me in an epiphany last night at about 10:30. Wait a minute. I get to read to my friends here tonight. So, which I'd rather do than put up some sort of dog and pony show for a slideshow. So what I wanted to do is read text from some of the great books. And I'm going to be reading to you from William Chittick's wonderful The Worcester Tornado of June 9th, 1953. Dave Ludlum's The Country Journal New England Weather Book. And I said, what story would be best to read to you? And I wanted to give you not just nuts and bolts, I have to give you that, but the personal detail, the town-by-town stories. And Larry Pletcher, in his Massachusetts Disasters book, does a wonderful job covering that. So off we go. What I'm going to try to do is bring you up to where the tornado emerged from, and then we'll go to the personal stories. The storm that became the Worcester Tornado can be traced to the Amsterdam-Ballston Spa area of New York around 1:30 p.m. on June 9, 1953. Observers from the GE Labs in Schenectady at that time noticed thunderheads forming a few miles to their north, and their remarks were prophetic. And I quote, "At 1:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Standard Time, several large towering cumulonimbus cloud formations were noted just north of the laboratory. Their vertical growth was so rapid as to resemble the effects observed with time-lapse motion pictures of large cumulus clouds. At this time, a counterclockwise motion was observed within the cloud mass, which at that time consisted of 8 to 10 separate towers." What they're saying is they see a monster developing. During this period, they had a camera focused to the east, and it captured some marvelous images of a towering cloud. Well, from their vantage point, there was no such thing as a tornado warning in those days. The science of meteorology was still in its infancy for all intent and purpose. And meanwhile, there was a tornado 2 days previous on June 7th, 1953 in Nebraska that had killed people. And that's the storm that's moving eastward. In fact, tornadoes in Ohio and Michigan occurred a scant 16 hours earlier, killing 140 people. So in Boston, at the Weather Bureau at Logan Airport, they have a 10 a.m. staff meeting on the day of June 9th, 1953. Quote, and I apologize for the tech talk, and I'm going to break that down for you. There was some discussion at the meeting about the advisability of doing an unprecedented thing, including in the forthcoming 11:30 forecast, 11:30 in the morning, the word tornado. They've never issued a tornado warning before. It's never been done in the history of the United States. In the history of the United States Weather Bureau, they'd never mentioned that, and a tornado had never, ever been mentioned in a New England weather forecast. So prior to the day in question, even the expression locally severe thunderstorms had never been used in a Boston forecast on the ground that it would be unnecessarily alarming. Now, however, after grave consideration, they decided to break this precedent. The forecast that was prepared for Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island ran as follows. Quote, windy, partly cloudy, hot and humid with thunderstorms, some locally severe, developing this afternoon. This, then, was New England's first ever thunderstorm forecast, and it was issued at 11:30 a.m. on that historic Tuesday, June 9th, 1953. With that, the National Weather Bureau, the Massachusetts Weather Bureau, are off the hook. They did their job. They saw severe weather coming, and they issued a forecast accordingly. Of course, it's who happened to be listening to that forecast at 11:30 a.m. It's all luck. So, two trained teams of observers, far to the west in Albany, New York, Schenectady area, and far to the east in Boston, are calling for bad weather. But they're still making assumptions. You got to remember, we're during the Cold War years, 1953. Who's a communist? You're a communist. He's a communist. I'm a communist. We're all communists. None of us are communists. The first evidence of ominous thunderheads came around 2:45 p.m. in the extreme southern part of Bennington County, Vermont, adjacent to the Massachusetts border. Skies rapidly darkened between Pownall and Reedsboro as the gigantic 40,000-foot-high thunderclouds blotted out the sun and pummeled the rolling hills with incessant lightning, high wind, and enormous hailstones. By 3 o'clock, a scant 15 minutes later, the rotating supercell had burgeoned to an incredible 50,000 feet high and was now being picked up by MIT radar more than 90 miles away in Cambridge. Crossing into Franklin County, Massachusetts, from southwestern Windham County, Vermont, the storm rapidly increased and intensified. In Coleraine, it struck at 3:45 p.m., and that town was particularly hard hit, with reports of hailstones up to 3 inches in diameter. Tree limbs were falling. 4:10 p.m., in the Millers Falls, Irving area, the storm started mushrooming to a colossal 60,000 feet in height. And it disappeared. The tops disappeared from the MIT screens. They could record no clouds higher than 50,000 feet. They never thought they'd see a 60,000. You've got a monster inbound. Hailstones the size of baseballs rained down on adjacent Northfield as eastern Franklin County took the brunt of the storm. In the hill country of Petersham and Barrie, meanwhile, low rumbles of thunder could be heard off in the distance to the northwest from the vicinity of New Salem, infrequent at first, but generally getting steadier and moving more and more closer as the menacing storm appeared over the horizon. The sky was now very dark and still across the woods and woodlands of northwestern Worcester County. By 4:20 p.m., a rotating wall cloud had begun to develop over New Salem and was witnessed by fishermen at Quavon Reservoir, who scrambled for safety. Within minutes, a funnel spun eastward just over the Worcester County line in Petersham, and a new chapter in New England weather was about to be written. That was marvelously written by Bill Chittick in his Worcester Tornado book. Okay, so we're 4:30 now. Okay, we've got the warning. There's a tornado coming. It's moving east. It's intensifying. It's a huge cloud bank, the likes that hadn't been seen in years in Massachusetts. From here, we cut over to one of my heroes. I'm a weather historian. If you didn't know that, I have a passion for weather. This is probably the most current storm that I've studied. Normally, I cut things off at the hurricane at 38. I can tell you about storms all the way back to Columbus, but if you tell me about, did it snow this winter, I can't reference any storm. I don't pay attention to it, but I can tell you about ancient weather. So this is my debut lecture for the Worcester tornado, and it's so great to be here in Worcester to tell you about this. So now, my hero is David Ludlum. Here's a man who's done all the research for me. All I have to do, being the great bloviator, is just recant all of his research. So we move over. The first tornado descends from the clouds at Petersham shortly after 4:25 p.m., and it moves on a path of 46 miles to its dissolution in Southborough at about 5:45 p.m. Roughly, this is an 84-minute monster, a monster that lived for 84 minutes, a killer monster. A second tornado. People don't understand. They don't realize there were three tornadoes. I'm going to tell you about that in New England that day. And also, what did destruction to Worcester aside from the tornado? I'm going to ask, does anybody know what happened in Worcester that day? Something else happened. A fire. Okay? Normally, you don't have fires with tornadoes. But in Worcester, I'm going to talk to you at the tail end of the lecture, there was a fire, and that's another passion of mine. I'm an ardent historical fire chronologist. I think that this woman would need a chair. If somebody could accommodate her, that would be wonderful. Thank you so much for stepping up and taking the initiative on that matter. A second tornado now strikes Exeter, New Hampshire around 5:20 p.m., and a third traveled a 29-mile pass starting at Sutton, Massachusetts, about 5:30, and ending in Mansfield, Massachusetts, at 6:37. People don't realize there's a tornado that picks up after the Worcester tornado ceases and to the south. The three storms combined to take 94 lives, inflict over 400 major and 900 minor injuries, destroyed an estimated $53 million in property. That's 1953 dollars. All the fatalities, most of the injuries, and the bulk of the property losses were caused by the first tornado, mainly in and around in your hometown of Worcester. Here, the funnel attained its greatest intensity and a maximum width of almost 1 mile wide. This is a big, big maelstrom. So I said the first evidence of tornadic activity came at about 4:25 p.m. The funnel cloud lowered to the ground at a state forest abutting the northeastern shore of Quabbin Reservoir in the southeastern corner of Franklin County. It moved eastward 4 miles to a point about a mile southwest of the center of Petersham, and then the tornado swung southeastward, crossing routes 32 and 122 on a nearly straight course of 6 miles to Barrie. By the time it curved southeastward, the tornado had attained major force and expanded to an average width of 500 yards. There are indications that twin funnels moved through the Petersham area, but the second disturbance either dissipated or lifted aloft before reaching Barrie. The eastern part of the town was struck about 4:45 p.m. The tornado eventually skipped over the low and swampy country extending to Rutland, since there is little or no sign of damage along the 8-mile stretch intervening. Rutland was hit at about 4:53 p.m. It suffered most of its damage in a quarter-mile corridor along Main Street from the center of the town eastward to Route 56. And now here's the scary stuff, because I'm talking about literally 100 yards away from where we're sitting right now. Continuing southeastward 8 miles parallel to and about 1 mile south of Route 122A to Route 31 in Holden, the tornado for the first time reached heavily built up and populated areas. Simultaneously, in the vicinity of Chaffin Pond near Route 122A, its power increased and its path of destruction began to broaden. Thus, through the Holden, Worcester, Shrewsbury area, a distance of only 8 miles, the damage width averaged about 3/4 of a mile and reached a maximum of almost 1 mile in places. These localities suffered most of the deaths, injuries, and property destruction, and the havoc was virtually indescribable. Holden was struck at about 5:05 p.m., and soon afterward, the track cut across the northern extension of Worcester. It's called the Worcester Tornado, but it probably only hit less than 10% of Worcester, and it hit at 5:08 p.m. Okay? And I think at this point, I'm going to turn back to Larry Pletcher now. Well, I'm going to give you some more Worcester detail here. Quote, afterward, the track cut across the northern extension of Worcester, trending almost directly southeast. The northern edge followed Mountain Street closely, while the southern edge, somewhat wavering and irregular, passed north of Indian Lake and Burncoat Park. At the crossing of West Boylston Street, that's Route 12, the tornado was between 3 and 4 miles north of the Green in downtown Worcester. Maximum damage areas were in Holden, the residential sections from Main Street east to the Worcester line. In Worcester, the strip southeastward crossing Route 12, which is West Boylston Street, between Summit and Greendale to the northern reaches of Lake Quinsigamond, including the Greendale section, the Norton Company plant, Assumption College, the Great Brook Valley Housing Project, and the City Farm in Shrewsbury, the residential districts on and adjacent to Main Street, Maple Avenue, Crescent Street, Lake Street, Grafton Street, and South Street. If we were sitting here today, that monster would have gone right by us. And now I'm going to cut over to Larry Pletcher. So that gives us a technical flavor and a direction of where this thing came by. Now we're going to hear some personal stories. You're going to hear a bit of redundancies here as Larry just reiterates some of the facts that I've given you. Off we go then. On June 9th, 1953, readers of Worcester's Evening Gazette scanned the headlines with mixed emotions. The front page story about a killer tornado in Michigan and Ohio brought concern and sadness for the storm's victims, but also the comforting thought that the devastation caused by such massive winds could never, ever happen here. Tornadoes, after all, always strike in the cornfields of the Midwest, not in the hills of old New England. Little did those readers know that a murderous twister was preparing to pillage their own hometowns that very afternoon. Striking at about 5 p.m. on that rainy day in June, the deadliest tornado in New England history tore a 25-mile path through a dozen communities in central Massachusetts. Beginning in the town of Petersham, northwest of Worcester, the tornado swept southeast through Beverly, Rutland, and the northern end of the city of Worcester. Readers note, I think Larry missed that. It didn't go through Beverly. We all know Beverly's up on the North Shore. We're going to give old Larry a mulligan on that, though, aren't we? The funnel cloud then passed into Shrewsbury, and I'll go over the map with this, so not to worry. The funnel cloud then passed into Shrewsbury before splitting into two prongs and disappearing to the south and east. Hitting without warning, the nightmare storm took less than half an hour to blast its swath of destruction. George Jones and his wife had lived on their Petersham farm for only 8 days when they stood in their new home and watched a heavy rainstorm approaching beyond a hill to the northwest. They were the first people to see the killer tornado as it formed its funnel cloud. Quote, "When we saw the trees drawn up under the funnel, we wasted no time getting into the basement," Mr. Jones said. He grabbed his wife and dashed to the cellar. Just a few moments, the roaring cloud had passed overhead, and then all was quiet. The roof of their house was damaged, and trees that stood in their yard since colonial days were uprooted and blown down. Only a concrete pad remained where their barn had once stood. "It missed us," said Mr. Jones. "Thank God," his wife replied. As the swirling storm raged into the next town, other victims would not be so lucky. In Holden, mechanic Donald Buxton was greasing the customer's car at the end of a long workday. The big garage doors were closed because of the afternoon's heavy rain. Buxton told the Springfield Daily News, quote, "I heard a zinging sound, and the first thing I knew, my garage started to crumble. And then the car on the lift blew over, hitting a customer. And then the lift clipped me when I was falling." Spinning to look toward the street, Buxton then watched in disbelief as his young station attendant, John Holmes, was blown clean through the garage. A green car that was parked at the curb flew 25 feet through the air to the entrance of the service bay. "I jumped out of the way and then got hit by cinder blocks. The customer was buried in the blocks. He's in pretty bad shape." Buxton recalled this as he nursed his bandaged arm and his sore shoulder. Holmes wound up beneath a pile of debris behind the garage. The customer's car was a total loss. Early June is a time when many college students return home for summer vacation. Ray Sterling, a student at Cornell, was driving with his mother on the Worcester Turnpike in Fayetteville. When he saw the twister coming, he pulled into a gas station to wait for the storm to pass. Both managed to survive when the car was picked up, turned over three times, and dropped 150 feet from the station. Peter Volmes was fortunate enough to be only a witness and not a victim. A graduate of Syracuse University, Volmes was also driving on the Worcester Turnpike when he saw trees, power lines, and houses coming down. Blinded by the heavy rain, Volmes got out of his own car and found another vehicle on its roof with both of the occupants dead. He told the United Press International, 20 yards off the road, I saw another car with its roof smashed in. There were three people hurt. They asked me if I had any bandages. I didn't have any, but I gave one man my handkerchief." In Worcester, commencement exercises were held a week before the storm. The fortunate timing saved countless lives when the twister completely demolished dormitories and administrative buildings on the campus of Assumption College. Two nuns and a priest died. Luckily, no students were there to be injured. Atomic bombs and nuclear testing were hot topics in 1953. But it was a year that also saw more than its share of violent tornadoes. Politicians were quick to suggest a connection. Idiots. While the United States Weather Bureau and the Atomic Energy Commission denied that A-bomb tests were to blame for the nasty weather, at least one congressman called for an investigation. But Dr. Harry Wexler, chief of the Weather Bureau Scientific Services Division, patiently explained that the A-bomb is not a weather maker. It doesn't pack enough energy. An afternoon thundershower is a bigger energy machine than a standard atomic bomb. In other words, compared with the energy unleashed by the Worcester tornado, an A-bomb is rather puny. Scientists at the Blue Hills Observatory joined in attributing the New England tornado to a rare set of meteorological circumstances, not to A-bomb tests. Tornadoes are born when air masses that have extremely great differences of temperatures at different levels of the atmosphere collide. Usually, explain the meteorologists, by the time they reach the East Coast and meet hot air from the South, Pacific cold fronts warm up too much to cause twisters in New England. The rare Worcester tornado was spawned by the same unusually sharp squall line running ahead of a cold Canadian air front that brought tornadoes to Michigan and Ohio 24 hours earlier. Typical of large tornadoes, the Worcester storm brought lightning, thunder, rain, and massive hailstones. Its awesome funnel cloud screamed with winds swirling somewhere between 300 and 500 miles per hour. It was in 2005, they deemed this to be an F4 tornado with peak winds of 317 miles per hour. The immense power of the rare New England storm may excuse the local papers for continuing to exploit the A-bomb theme. The Springfield Daily News reported that eyewitnesses compared the damage in Worcester with pictures that they had seen of the damage wreaked by the atomic bombs on Japan in World War II. In the Worcester Evening Gazette, they carried news that six victims of the tornadoes are being treated for the same type of blast injuries to their lungs as that caused by an atomic bomb explosion. In fact, one man had his lungs blown out due to the air pressure, because you have extremely low air pressure when a tornado passes by. Within the swath of destruction, homes and businesses were pulverized in each of the small towns that stood in the path of the storm. In Fayetteville, Joseph Noberini, a police patrolman, was sitting with his family in the front room of their home when they saw wooden planks flying through the air outside. There was a terrific noise. Things started falling. Windows, glass, shingles all over us. All sorts of things were all over the kitchen. As soon as the storm passed, he desperately dug through the wreckage of the house next door. Beneath the debris, he found the bodies of his sister-in-law and nephew. In Shrewsbury, Fire Department Captain Lawrence Kershaw knew that that the twisting black thing was the second that he saw it. This is what he told the Worcester Evening Gazette. Quote, "The air was filled with flying things, planks, beams, broken chairs, parts of beds. The twister seemed to be picking the buildings it was about to destroy up in the air and smashing them down on the ground. It would dive down and wreck a house and then maybe skip one or two, then come down again for another. It seemed to rise and fall like waves, picking up part of a house, chewing it up, and then spitting it out in pieces. Damage was severe in rural sections in the storm's path. Dazed cattle lay in a field with stanchions still fashioned around their necks. 16-year-old Marshall Lytle ran to a collapsed barn on the Weagle farm. The cows were mooing all over the place, just sitting there and not moving about much. But there was no roof, no walls, nothing. Just the cows mooing and mooing. The young man also discovered the body of his hired hand beneath the barn's debris. Blood was all over. His face and chest were covered with blood. I almost fainted. But the heavily populated city of Worcester was the primary target of the twister's malevolent fury. More than 200,000 souls lived in the city, and many of those residents were concentrated in housing projects and veterans' homes in the northern end of the town. And where did the tornado pass through? The northern end of the town. As fate would have it, this densely populated region received the brunt of the storm. Before the storm, the Brookside home had facilities to care for 300 people. After the twister, the wreckage was nearly complete. The dormitory barracks, the farm buildings, the laundry, and the garage were all level. Joe Sullivan, age 63, was one of 20 men who were plunged 18 feet into a basement when a stairway gave way. Sullivan told the Worcester Evening Gazette that the roof was blown off. They ran for the stairway, but it had been torn away. "We all landed in the basement. I was knocked out. When I came to, I looked up and no roof, no walls, nothing. Nothing left on the foundation. My friends were there with me, but they were all knocked out cold." In fact, five of his friends were dead. The main building lost its roof, but was largely spared. Only the fact that most residents were eating dinner in the main hall kept the death toll lower. Before the storm, 3,000 people lived in the Great Brook Valley public housing projects. While private homes nearby went undamaged, the Curtis Apartments with 300 units and Great Brook Valley Gardens with 600 units suffered direct hits. For one witness who spoke to the Worcester Evening Gazette, the full horror of the Twister's devastation didn't seem real until he viewed the remains of the Great Brook Valley Veterans Housing Project.
"It looked like it had been pounded by a heavy artillery barrage. Houses were torn from their foundations and reduced to scrap lumber. Kitchen sinks stood in open lawns. Baby carriages, garden furniture littered the area everywhere. Bedding, pots, pans, chairs, tables, kitchen curtains all scrambled together like a crazy rummage sale." In the aftermath of the corkscrew storm, the National Guard sealed off the area of the housing projects while rescue teams chopped down locked doors and probed through mangled debris in a desperate search for the missing. Ken Mallett left his dry cleaning shop as soon as the wind died down and hurried to the scene of devastation. His delivery truck soon became a makeshift ambulance. He told the Worcester Evening Gazette, "I made four trips altogether. There was one load with a boy, 8 or 10, and he died on the way. There was another one, a girl about 6, her left leg hanging by a thread. Everybody was bleeding. I had them packed in like sardines." When night fell, the only lights in the neighborhood were either cast by emergency floodlights or flickered from handheld flashlights as crews continued to probe the wreckage. In all the mayhem caused by the killer Twister, the fate of the Auslan baby gripped the public's attention and came to symbolize the tragic event. Alone at home with her 2-week-old son, young Mrs. Auslan snatched the baby from its crib and ran outside when the Twister approached. "I thought it would be safer outside," the devastated mother wept, recovering in the Holden Hospital from her own internal injuries. "Mrs. Auslan said, the wind tore the baby from my arms and carried it away. And then I was knocked down, and I don't remember anything else." For 3 days, local papers reported the futile efforts to find the Auslan baby. The mother had been found lying in the road more than 60 yards from her house, so a frantic and intensive search had to scour the entire neighborhood where 160 homes had been demolished. "Do you smell something burning?" "Yes, no, toast.
Toast?
Okay." I had a friend whose nickname was Toast in high school. As many as 150 friends, neighbors, and concerned citizens tore through tangled debris for 2 days. "Where can we look? What can we do to help?" a weary searcher asked. "We're searching as much as we can, and everywhere we can. There aren't many more places we can look." Finally, on the third day, Melvin Gardeff, a neighbor and friend of the Auslan family, put an end to the awful ordeal. He spotted the baby's body beneath the rubble of several houses more than 400 yards away from the Osmond's home. Excuse me. As usual, everyday heroes emerge in the wake of disaster. In Worcester, a 17-year-old, Richard Peretti, pulled a pair of twin boys out from beneath the wreckage of a 3-story tenement building. Throughout the region, police, firemen, volunteers, and military personnel poked through and prodded through acres of debris to release and treat scores of trapped victims. Lighter moments were few and far between. An unidentified woman hurried into the Red Cross emergency response unit and asked to be allowed back into her home. She wanted to look for her false teeth.
There you go, there's your joke there, brother.
The Twister had blown them right out of her mouth. Carl Waltz Jr. was completing his paper route when the Twister hit. He had nothing to do but cling to a tree. A friendly neighbor called him into her home just before the tree was uprooted by the wind and swept away. In Worcester, a frantic mother called the police looking for her child. She was told that her one-year-old had been found safely wandering along a sidewalk several blocks away. The terrible winds of that June afternoon killed thousands of songbirds by stripping many of them of their feathers. The winds carried a copy of a Worcester newspaper 40 miles to Boston. After the storm dropped baseball-sized hail on parts of central Massachusetts, it picked up birth certificates, checkbooks, photographs, and a music box and deposited them as far away as Quincy in Cape Cod Bay. The Worcester tornado left 90 people dead and as many as 10,000 people homeless. Many of the surviving victims were simply left wondering in stunned disbelief what had hit them. In 30 minutes, without warning, a storm that could never happen here had changed many lives forever. Right now, we're going to take just a brief moment of silence to honor the victims of the Worcester tornado, and then we'll go back to questions and some more on this topic. Thanks for your kindness and for honoring those victims. We talk about the Fujita Scale. It was created in 1971 by a University of Chicago professor by the name of T. Theodore Fujita. He wanted to rate a tornado's severity from those that caused light damage to catastrophic events. So the scale's estimates of destructive wind speeds were revised, people don't know about this, in February of 2007. So now there's a new enhanced Fujita Scale, also adding damage indicators aimed at refining the categorization of tornadoes. So the old Fujita scale, an F0 was 40 to 72 miles per hour, an F1, 73 to 112 miles per hour, an F2, 113 to 157 miles per hour, an F3, 158 to 207 miles per hour, an F4, from 208 to 260 miles per hour, and F5 from 261 to 318 miles per hour. The reason why I'm telling you this is because I think the Worcester tornado was an F5 and it shouldn't have been downgraded to an F4. So the new Fujita scale basically makes it that the minimum winds have to be 65 miles an hour to be an F0, not 40 miles per hour. An F1 begins at 86 miles per hour, or an EF1. Enhanced Fujita scale. An EF2 begins at 111 miles per hour. An EF3 begins at 136 miles per hour. An EF4 begins at 166 miles per hour. And an EF5 begins at more than 200 miles per hour. So based upon peak velocity winds of 317 miles per hour, we're an F6 here. Some tornado tips. You are in a dangerous weather zone because of the valley and the corridor that you're in. You get more snow than we do in Boston. You get more severe thunderstorms than we do in Boston. These are tips. Just remember these, please. Opening some windows in the house may help, but be sure to stand clear of the windows once you open them. All right? Head for the basement of your house immediately and try to take cover under heavy furniture. If your house does not have a basement, take cover near the center of the house on the first floor, preferably in a small space such as a closet or a bathroom. Never take shelter in a large enclosed space such as an auditorium or shopping mall. Mobile homes are particularly threatened by tornadoes and should be evacuated immediately during a tornado warning. If you should be caught out in the open, move away from the tornado's path as quickly as possible at what? At right angles to the tornado's path. If you should be caught out in the open, once again, move away from the tornado as quickly as possible at a right angle to the tornado's path. A few more data here. Let's just talk about that fire that I spoke of, okay? I'm going to give you the casualty count right now and the cost. Break it down by towns. Just again, going over that path, it begins in Petersham, just due east of the Quabbin. It goes through Barry, maybe Nick's Oakham, Rutland, Holden, north quadrant of Worcester, maybe Nick's a southwestern quadrant of Boylston, Shrewsbury, Westboro, and dies in Southboro. That other tornado to the south that picks up when Worcester Tornado dies goes from Sutton through Northbridge, Riverdale, Hopedale, Bellingham, Franklin, Wrentham, Foxborough, and ends in Mansfield. Let's look at the death toll. The death toll. I'm going to give you the town, the deaths, major and minor, okay? Petersham, no deaths, no injuries, $128,000 damage. Barry, no deaths, no injuries, $100,000 damage. These are 1953 dollars. That's when the dollar meant something. Rutland, two deaths, 14 major injuries, 30 minor injuries, $368,000. Holden, 10 deaths, 36 major injuries, 173 minor injuries, $5 million worth of damage. Worcester, 62 deaths, 327 major injuries, 411 minor injuries, $32,100,000 worth of damage. Shrewsbury, 6 deaths, 37 major injuries, 156 minor injuries, $8.9 million worth of damage. Westboro, 5 deaths, 12 major injuries, 50 minor injuries, $5 million worth of damage. Southborough, 5 deaths, 10 major, 32 minor injuries, $547,000 worth of damage. Other deaths were 4. In addition, the Exeter tornado caused minor injury to 5 persons and did $100,000 damage. The Sutton-Wrentham tornado, that's the ditty to the south there, seriously injured 2 and caused minor injuries to 15 persons. Total damage in the towns of Sutton, Northbridge, Franklin, and Wrentham amounted to $671,000. The total deaths in the afternoon of June 9, 1953, have been placed at 94, and the total damage at $53 million. Now we're going to just talk quickly about the fires, and we're going to go to some questions here. Who was the senator of Massachusetts that came to examine Shrewsbury that year? Does anybody know? Famous picture of him was taken with a 15 and 13-year-old. The senator of Massachusetts in 1953 who walked through Shrewsbury. Anybody? I'll give you a hint. He became president.
John F. Kennedy.
That's correct. Well, there were some signs of smoke. First, it was a house on Eunice Avenue. House was on fire after the tornado passed by. Then along Burncoat Street, fires broke out on Francis Street. Combustible three-deckers were burning on Francis Street. One of the three-deckers collapsed while another still burned. A single-family home caught fire on Francis Street. Finally, they got some water from the bottom of the hill, but it took about an hour to get up there. Then the National Guard started arriving. They came streaming down Ontario Street. The Norton Company destroyed. Cars that had been blown out of the Norton Company parking lot were found 50, 100 yards away. Anybody remember Burncoat Street, an ice cream place called Holmes? It's now a bank. Deadliest tornadoes in U.S. history. Worcester ranks what? Out of the top 25, where do you think Worcester ranks in the deadliest tornadoes in history?
Number
20. Deadliest ever was the Tri-State Tornado of March 18, 1925. Went through Missouri, Illinois, and Indiana, 695 people dead. Second was the Natchez, Mississippi. May 6, 1840, 317 died. Third was St. Louis, Missouri. May 27, 1896, 255 people died. I will say this. For years, New Orleans worried about what striking them. A hurricane. What happened? Katrina wiped out the city. St. Louis and the safety departments there are just so nervous about another tornado. That city would be devastated if it took a dead-on strike. They were devastated at the close of the 19th century. So watch for that when you hear a tornado go near St. Louis. They're in Tornado Alley. Fourth most deadliest, Tupelo, Mississippi, April 5th, 1936, 216 dead. And the fifth highest, Gainesville, Georgia, 203 dead on April 6th, 1936. That was a tornado outbreak. Flint, Michigan, the day before Worcester tornado, was ranked ninth deadliest. 115 died in Flint, Michigan on June 8th, 1953. And just out of comparison, a month earlier in Waco, Texas, on May 11th, 1953, 114 died. So 1953 was not a good year for people. I'm going to close with the 10 worst killers in New England history, okay, of tornadoes. I'm going to read them to you first. August 15, 1787, Connecticut. The main funnel touched down in Wethersfield, but severe storms also were reported in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island. A woman and her son were caught in the open and killed. Clothes from their house were carried 3 miles. September 9, 1821, New Hampshire. Known today as the Sunday Tornado and the Great New Hampshire Whirlwind, this twister stands with the 1953 Worcester Tornado as the most violent in New England history. At least 5 persons were killed as the storm moved southeast across the rugged terrain from Cornish to 12 miles northwest of Concord. Had it hit a densely populated area, it might have produced a huge death toll. As it happened, most of the damage was to forests. September 9, 1821, same day, but in Massachusetts. Later that same day, another funnel struck about 50 miles to the south of the New Hampshire Twister. The storm killed 2 and moved east-southeast from 1 mile south of Northfield to Warwick, Orange, and Royalston, Mass. The account book of a tavern was carried aloft for 45 miles. August 9, 1878, Connecticut. A twister passed along the north side of Wallingford, killing 31 people and destroying 30 homes, a church, and a schoolhouse. July 16, 1879, Massachusetts. At least 7 tornadoes hit eastern New York and western New England on this date. The funnel first touched down at Pittsfield, damaging the whole region and leaving 3 persons dead. Bear with me, we're in the home stretch here. July 26, 1890, Massachusetts. The tornado struck at 9:15 in the morning. That's rare. You don't hear about tornadoes at 9:15 a.m. Just as nighttime tornadoes are rare. You usually hear about tornadoes when, you guys? When? Late in the afternoon. That's correct. Late in the afternoon. This struck at 9:15 a.m. just north of Lawrence in 1890, July 26th. 25 houses were destroyed. 500 people were left homeless, and 8 people died. It's the only killer tornado in New England history that occurred in the morning. We talked about Worcester. Just here's some data I want to give you, though. June 9th, 1953, Massachusetts. The Worcester County tornado equaled in size and intensity the most powerful storms seen in the western United States. Winds estimated at over 300 miles per hour rampaged along a discontinuous path for 46 miles from Rutland through Holden, Worcester, Shrewsbury, Westboro, and Southboro. 94 people were killed, over 1,200 injured, 10,000 left homeless, $53 million worth of damage. A piece of a frozen mattress fell from the sky into Boston Harbor, 40 miles to the east. Though the 94 deaths are often assumed to have occurred in Worcester, they were actually spread over six communities. 3 more to tell you about, and then I want to go to the first recorded tornado in American history, and we're done. August 28, 1973, Massachusetts. 6 houses were destroyed and 4 people killed when a funnel touched down at Canaan, New York, then roared through West Stockbridge. 3 of the deaths were at a truck stop in West Stockbridge, the other in one of the homes. August 10, 1979, Massachusetts. 2 boys were killed by falling trees at different locations in a Boy Scout camp at Paxton. This was probably the least violent of all the tornadoes on the list, with wind speeds of around 100 miles per hour. And finally, October 3rd, 1979, in Connecticut, 100 buildings were destroyed and 3 persons were killed in Windsor Locks, Connecticut. Several historic aircraft stored at an air museum at Bradley Airport were also ripped apart by the storm. Then I got one last thing to tell you here, and we are done, and I'd like to hear your personal recollections, if you have them, of the Worcester tornado, and then also if you remember any other whirlwinds or other tornadoes that you have relatives that either were involved with or your vivid recollections. This is known as John Winthrop's sudden gust. John Winthrop was the first governor of Massachusetts. It happened on July 15, 1643. It's America's first recorded tornado by an Anglo-Saxon. Quote, Winthrop, by the way, was a four-term governor of Massachusetts from 1630 to 1649. There arose a sudden gust at northwest, so violent for half an hour, as it blew down multitudes of trees. It lifted up their meeting house at Newbury, the people being in it. It darkened the air with dust, yet through God's great mercy, it did no hurt, but only killed one Indian. I hate that line. With the fall of a tree. It was straight between Lynn and Hampton. And so it went due north from Boston. And that, my friends, is the conclusion of my talk this morning. Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
I can contribute to the man I'm going to speak of. The man I'm going to speak of. His father was my eye doctor. I made him a memorial in 27 years near Clemson College. He was coming back, I believe it was Kendrick Avenue, with his mother and another woman from Greendale. They drew a plain bridge. They're right there by Assumption College, which had, the property had belonged to a relative of my grandmother's originally. He sold it to Assumption. His tiger shipped over, and the other, one of the women got killed. I just saw the man a few years ago. I knew his father very well. He's my eye doctor, and I saw it in the paper. I didn't recognize him. When I read it, I read the name. He looked just like his father, much bigger. But he was a lawyer. He survived, and I guess with his mother, the other woman got killed.
Just a minute. Yes, sir. Yes.
I got a lot of stories, but this is the one that really...
I'll take a couple. Give me two.
All right. My uncle and I, we volunteered for the Great Stone Post to go up to Shrewsbury and to help pick up the debris. They had a national guard there. And this was off of Main Street, I think, Old Gav. And I'll never forget walking down. On one side, six or seven houses were completely destroyed. On the other side, the houses were intact. There were kids' toys in the lawn that weren't even touched. There was a tree, I couldn't put my hands around it, but it was about 6 feet high, and I would estimate maybe thousands of spines, like toothpicks coming up, that the tree was just sheared off, twisted like a green splint. This is the last thing that really upset me. They told us to take a break. Ray Stone would come around with all kinds of stuff. Yes, I am going to tell him that, to eat and so forth. We walked, they were set up a Red Cross station and a Salvation Army station. So my uncle says, well, let's go down and have some donuts and coffee. Red Cross was charging 25 cents for donuts and coffee. Next house over, the thing there was a Salvation Army. They yelled to us, hey, fellas, over here, we got it for nothing. From that day on, I have not given a cent to the Red Cross. That really bothers
you. You have every right, sir. Do you know how wealthy they are now since Katrina? Do you know how much money they're sitting on right now as we're in crisis? Okay, and I don't mean they do a lot of good, but right now they're one of the most wealthiest companies. I shouldn't call them a company, but you have every right. Keep going, sir. Give me some more. This is what I'm here for. As a researcher, this is where I get my give back.
I'll let someone else.
Okay, but just think of another one. Yes, sir.
Okay. I was 6 years old at the time. I was living in Shrewsbury on Walnut Street. Well, my mother had taken me uptown for a haircut, and it was a very hot afternoon. We finished the haircut, and my mother was driving me home in her car, and she saw a very threatening overcast ahead, and she got very nervous and speeded up. And we got home to Walnut Street, and no sooner had we gotten home than down it came. The sky turned almost black. The rain came down, thunder, lightning, hailstones. She had me out on the front porch of the house watching the storm, and there were these planter boxes on the porch with geraniums in them. A hailstone as big as a lima bean landed in that planter box right in front of my young nose. I can still see it to this day. I mean, I at that tender age, my head was spinning at the wonder of this. I'd never seen a storm like that before, neither had she. All of a sudden, just as quickly as it had started, the rain, hail, and thunder stopped, the sun came out, and down the street came Paul Kessley of the family that ran Kessley and Morse in Worcester. He called to my mother and said, "Oh, Mrs. Allen, I'm glad you're all right. Did you know that that was a tornado?" My mother screamed, "What?" you know, she was horrified. Well, at the same time, I later heard this, my father was driving home from work. He worked at the Old State Mutual Company. And he saw the tornado cloud going across the horizon, and he was one scared puppy, I'll tell you that right now. He got home as soon as he can. He got to the house, made sure his family was all right. Well, the next day, my father took me for a ride in the car. We went down Maple Avenue in Shrewsbury. What a mess! Roofs off, doors torn from the hinges, chimneys down. One whole house was flattened completely out. And that used to be a tree-shaded lane at one time. Just about all the trees were gone. My mother often said to anybody that would listen to her that if she'd seen that tornado cloud, she would have died of shock. She probably would have too. Very nervous woman, very nervous.
Did you tell about your
mom? Well, I told her. Okay. But the fact of the matter is, ever since then, I've had a morbid fear that we'll get a repeat performance someday.
You have every right to have that morbid fear. In fact, that's a good defensive posture. Outstanding delivery, sir, on that story. If you think of another, okay, yes, sir.
This story goes. I was on this porch. The tornado came between these two houses. We were on the porch. It spun my father around. It came around the back of the house. Didn't touch us. It took all the other trees down, and did damage on those houses going across Lake Winsigamon. How it never damaged these two houses. And yet it took that out is beyond me. And that's what happened back in those days.
So, yes.
I was in high school at the time, and I went to North High, and a lot of my friends lived in the Burnco Street area and lost everything but the clothes on their back. They were just devastated up there. And I was working in a pharmacy at the time. And my boss said to me, "Anyone who comes in, give them whatever they need. Don't even ask them for a payment." He just gave everybody.
And they God were bless that man.
For things like toothbrushes, deodorant, toothpaste, just the staples. And I'm thinking, these poor people have nothing now. You know, it's like that house that went down on Pleasant Street from the fire a couple of weeks ago. Those people walked out of there with nothing. Except their lives, which was a big thing. But the following day at school, a whole group of us left school. I don't think they even took attendance that day because a lot of those kids were students. And we went up to the Burncoat Street area and tried to help out. I think I was enlisted to roll bandages. But it was just devastating to see all this, you know, these beautiful homes and everything just gone. It was a real tragedy.
Another one, sir?
And I was only a kid.
One of my best friend's father, his name was Cliff Johnson, was a policeman. And he told stories that he was one of the first police to be called and come in that area. And he made three trips from the apartments there to City Hospital. And what he recalls, people walking in shock. He said he saw a man carrying a fishbowl with a fish, goldfish in it, had no pants and a t-shirt on, and he was just walking. He was in state of shock. People he took into his car were bleeding, and he just put him in a back seat and just took right off and got him to the hospital. They were waiting at City Hospital. Thank God, you know, for all these emergency coming in. But he was telling of stories that people would, you wouldn't believe that, were just walking around in the daze from that wind that happened. It was incredible.
Anybody else? May I ask you, did anybody raise your hand, please, and recall your recollections? Did anybody see the smoke from the fire? Does anybody remember hearing about the fires? Interesting.
I wasn't alive yet, so I have no memory of it.
Does anybody want to relay secondhand stories that they heard? Any anecdotes? Great. Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure speaking here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.